From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in an American legend, the legend of John Henry. And I'm going to read now from a recent piece of medical literature talking about something called John Henryism. Do you know the story of John Henry? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Let me tell you a little bit about it. John Henry was the so-called steel driving man. The legend, familiar to some Americans, is that John Henry was known far and wide in the late 19th century railroad and tunnel workers for his remarkable physical strength, his endurance. It was at the mouth of the Big Bend Tunnel in West Virginia in the early 1870s, or so the story goes, that John Henry beat a mechanical steam drill in a famous steel driving contest. It was man against machine, and he won, a close race throughout. But a series of powerful blows from his 9-pound hammer in the closing seconds, John Henry emerged the victor. But he put so much physical and mental exertion into that race that moments after it, he dropped dead from exertion. That's the legend of John Henry. And so now, what are we talking about when we talk about John Henryism? Well, Sherman James wrote a paper called John Henryism and the Health of African Americans. And the story is, I don't want to oversimplify it, but let me put it this way. White people in particular sometimes imagine that it might be difficult to not be white, that it'd be difficult to be black, to experience racism. But we can actually quantify it in studies, and it's been studied many times. And the idea of John Henryism is the exertion it takes just to go through life as a person of color, as an African American. The exertion it takes on our physical health, on mental health, and that leads to higher hypertension, blood pressure, depression rates, suicide attempts. That's John Henryism. Just comparing white people to African Americans, just the effort to be African American, to endure racism, and starting from scratch, just as a baseline, what the cost is, the psychic cost of being black. I was fascinated by that paper and also a book on a subject of mental health in the African American community. And the book is Psychiatry and Racial Liberalism in Harlem, 1936 to 1968. I was joking with the author before the program began. It's one of the most specific and esoteric book titles I've ever introduced on this program, but it matters. This is a period of American history and a place that really matters when it comes to mental health in the black community. Dennis Doyle is the author of the book. He is in Rochester today. Dennis is an associate professor of history at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy and author of Psychiatry and Racial Liberalism in Harlem, 1936 to 1968. The event tonight at 5 o'clock at Rush Reese Library. Dennis, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Melanie Funches is here. Melanie is Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. Melanie, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It was my basic outline fair enough? I want to tell me more about just understanding the psychic cost, John Henryism, these kind of terms, because Melanie, you know, walked right in and said, absolutely, we know that this is real. This is not just an idea.
No, this is very real. There are a number of studies that have been done, and there's been meta-analysis of all of these things that say that there is a physical cost to the experience, the repeated experience of oppression experienced by African-American people. And one of the things they talk about, there's a documentary called Uncommon Causes, are inequality making us sick. And in part of that, they talk about how when you look at African-American women and you look at birth rates, and they looked at educated African-American, like college-educated African-American women of middle-class status have some of the same birth outcome rates as teenage white, young white women, white girls without a high school diploma. And if you control for everything else, it's about the physical toll on our bodies of experiencing racism, you know, and oppression on the daily basis. It's like the air. And, you know, people say, well, Melanie, what do you mean by that? I'm like, it's like the air. If you are seeing a police car pull up behind you, and your heart rate automatically accelerates. You're having, you know, all these things. Your breathing accelerates just because you see it. It doesn't have to stop. You don't have to have done anything wrong. But if you're having these experiences because of what you know that can happen, that wears on you. And that's just what that is.
And so I think before the program began, you mentioned sort of a difference in effective age among races.
Yes, there is a study that talks about telomeres, which are these little ends on our DNA, and they basically chronicle your organ age. And when you take Black women, and if you look at the telomeres, Black women internally are 7.5 years older than their white counterparts. And we talked, and a group of us, we were looking at the study, and we looked at this because there's a saying talk about Black doesn't crack, that Black women age magnificently. We look fabulous into old age, right? And so that being said, but internally we age faster. So if me and my girlfriend are, you know, young professionals, we're getting married, we're having babies, and we're both 30 chronologically, her body is 30. She's white. Her body is 30. I'm 37 and a half. We know what happens for women giving birth later, the potential for birth defects and trouble and hard pregnancies. So if we know this, you know, we know that this is going on, there's consequences to that. And that's just, and when you regulate for everything else, it's come out in the literature that it's because of racism and oppression.
Dennis, you decided to write this book and focus on this particular community and this issue. Why? Tell me about that.
Well, it has to go back to two interests that I've always had in history, and that's history of African Americans and then history of medicine, particularly mental health and psychiatry. And at the time when I got into grad school, there were very few people working on the intersection of those two. And I thought that was a real shame. So I thought there was a gap that needed to be filled, and it would give me a dissertation to work on. But it was really something that I just gravitated to because I saw the injustice of the fact that there wasn't scholarship on this. And I really, what interests me as a scholar are injustices and inequalities. That's what I'm really drawn to, those stories.
When you say racial liberalism, let's be specific what you mean.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not the kind of a talk radio buzzword that it's, you know, it is now. The definition is very specific to that period of 30s to 60s. It refers to a very self-selected group of people who actually worked within the public sector, who shared the same belief, or essentially almost faith, that the Black psyche and the white psyche were functionally equivalent, that there was no justification for policies and practices based on the assumption that there were innate differences. And so these are folks that are good, well-positioned in places in social welfare, the court system, in social work and education, to be able to enact policy to promote expansion of psychiatry for African-Americans.
You open the book with a story of Martin Luther King, where this is 1958.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Isola Ware Curry, I think, was the name of a woman, an African-American woman, who stabbed him.
Yeah.
What happened?
One of the first assassination attempts. He was giving a book signing at Blumstein's department store, and she showed up with a metal letter opener and stuck it into his chest. He had to be taken to Harlem Hospital. And they did perform surgery there and saved his life. And then she was whisked away to Bellevue Hospital, the infamous Bellevue Hospital, for psychiatric evaluation. And of course, found that she was psychotic, severely psychotic. But the really fascinating part of the story is she was not known to a single mental health authority before this point. Harlem Hospital is not equipped to diagnose or handle someone like her, and not a single psychiatrist had heard of her.
Shouldn't have been that way.
No, shouldn't have been that way. Harlem Hospital was, you know, the major metropolitan hospital serving the area between 110th and the tip of Manhattan, the area known as Harlem. It was chronically underserved for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with racial inequality and discrimination within New York City's system of politics and healthcare. And as a result, just wasn't able to provide the services that would have been able to suss out someone like Curry and perhaps prevent what happened at Blumstein's department store that day.
How old was she at the time?
I can't remember. Yeah, it wasn't that. She was mid-30s,
okay,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need the exact age, but mid-30s or so.
Yeah.
So then, now let's go back, Melanie. I'm thinking of children growing up. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about just the psychic cost of being African-American and the racism and the impacts that we know are actually having a measurable effect, you know, if you're mid-30s and you've had no help, no medical community sort of intervention at all, go back to childhood. What is the impact on kids when we are not recognizing the growing cumulative effects of kids dealing with racism in our unequal society?
To make sure that we don't get this twisted, I want to make sure that in the case of Ms. Curry, medical professionals didn't know about her, but the community knew. If you talked, everyone in the community knew that this
family,
woman, the family, the community knew that that she had some mental health issues.
Oh, for sure.
But the issue wasn't about the thing is the issue that community was under-resourced. And because of that community being under-resourced because of racial practices and racialized medicine, because there's a whole nother piece that during that period in time, psychiatry practiced something called racialized medicine, where they believed that African-Americans did not have the mental capacity to benefit from psychiatry. And this was a pervasive, widely accepted practice. So I want to make sure that we understand that in the context of Ms. Curry and that situation, this was the context of what was going
absolutely.
On. And some of that is persistent today in the fact that there are people who, there are communities, our communities are under-resourced in having culturally responsive care. You know, it's not so much that our kids, yes, our kids are exposed to trauma and these things happen, but a bigger part of this is our communities, there is an under-resourcing of skilled African-American, Latino, you know, practitioners and people who can do culturally responsive therapeutic care for African-Americans in this community. So if you are a child growing up and you're having a challenge, we know from prevalence data across everyone that 1 in 5 youth will have a diagnosable mental health condition. But of that number, only 20% will ever see a practitioner. And if you add to that, you know, the disparities for people of color and people in poverty and all those other things, that just compounds that even more.
Looking at the data, according to the American Psychological Association, African-American psychologists made up 5.3% of the active psychology workforce as recently as 2013.
Yep. That's nationally.
How are we going to change? So then you start looking at just the embedded racism that says, well, African-Americans, you know, couldn't handle psychological intervention, let alone become psychologists or become psychiatrists or working in the field. How are we going to start changing that, Melanie?
Part of the key to this is just around, you know, this is with disparities in all of our areas. This is about disparities in any area. It's about the psychiatrist. It's about psychologists. It's about teachers. It's about nursing. It's going to the places where those people are. It's not that Black people are not going to school and going to psychiatry as a discipline. It's not that they're not going into psychology as a discipline. But we as systems, you know, our hospital system, the University of Rochester Medical Center, Rochester Regional Health, you know, UR Medicine and Rochester Regional have to go. If they have to go to Meharry Medical College, which is a Black medical school in Nashville, Tennessee, to go get some doctors, go get them. If you have to go to the HBCUs, go get these people. We're not unicorns. The people exist. And you just have to it has to be about a will. A sense of will that we understand that we have a need. If you needed, if we needed especially cardiothoracic surgeon, I am more than sure that they would go out to the end of the earth and pay the money to get that person. We need culturally responsive mental health care for our people. And if we do not have those people in this community, we need to make the will as a community. If we say we care about our kids, we say we care about families and all of them equally, that we will go get the people who can do the job.
All right, let's go back to Harlem, 1958. So Ms. Curry ends up at Bellevue, Dennis?
Yeah, for a psych evaluation, before she's eventually institutionalized.
And Martin Luther King himself said after recovering, after I think you said a delicate surgery, a bout of pneumonia, but said he hopes that she gets the care that she needs. But so much of the community wasn't equipped to do that. So what was the story at Bellevue?
Sorry, Bellevue, it really fits right well with what Melanie was saying. Bellevue was well known within African American community as a place you did not want to go. This was a, especially the psychiatric ward, was one that was run by folks who believe deeply that African Americans were not capable of benefiting from psychotherapy, that they did not have the innate psychological capacity to benefit from it. And so that was the, if you went to Bellevue, you were going to be treated to substandard care. You're going to be misevaluated, misrecognized. They even were not even quite sure that African Americans were capable of being diagnosed as psychotic because they didn't really quite know if the black race as a whole wasn't just as part of their normal functioning, close to what we would call psychotic.
Just a super racist framework of looking at things.
Yeah. So it was pervasive throughout the psychiatric wards, especially the adolescent ward in particular. So it was not a place you'd want to go. It was a place you wish to avoid. So someone like Curry, her family, they knew about her, but they would not have wanted her to have gone to Bellevue before because they knew that you don't want her to go there and you're not going to see her again.
And so what was it that at least started to bring about change? I think you highlighted in the book that you couldn't just point to one thing, racial liberalism or, you know, changing views of equality. But how would you describe what at least started to bring about change? Not saying we're anywhere near where we need to be today.
Oh, absolutely.
But understanding that 1958 Harlem was very different.
Oh, yeah. It goes back to actually the 1930s when a group of people well-placed individuals, managed because of the election of Mayor Fiero LaGuardia. What helped to get him in office was essentially some very left-leaning segments of the population that formerly had been neglected. So once they had elected him, he rewarded some of their leading lights to positions of power, especially within child welfare and health and education and criminal justice. And those folks came to the table with very different perspectives. They came from backgrounds that included socialism or the Black freedom struggle or ethical culture or Reform Judaism. And so they didn't come with the prejudice that the Black psyche was inherently different from the white psyche. So when they entered spaces where psychiatry was going to serve as a tool, like in the criminal justice system or the courts or education, they were not going to just fall for some psychiatrist coming in saying, oh, well, I don't know if they're psychotic as a race or psychotic as individuals. They weren't going to fall for it and just say, no. Blacks and whites are the same psychologically. There's psychological equality between the races. So those folks came in at the right moment in the 1930s, between 1930s. In the 1940s, began to enact change that would expand psychiatric care through education, through courts, and criminal justice to provide additional sources of psychiatric care that just wasn't available in Harlem.
Hmm. Now, Melanie, how do you view the history sort of evolving views and I don't want to say treatment or just the creation of an unequal racist system of psychiatric care versus, you know, what started to change that over the decades?
Well, what happened in psychiatry was not anything different than what happened across medicine.
That's a great
point. Or across, I mean, I don't want to point out psychiatry as being some anomaly where racialized treatment was done. I mean, it happened across medicine, it happened across education, it happened across all systems. And so what happened in this case, what is highlighted, what Dr. Doyle Apper highlights in the book is that there's a set of folk who were strategically placed in a set of positions that were allowed to put forward a different idea. Because we, you know, my thing is from what their knowledge was at that time, we talked about this earlier that, you know, it, you know, their efforts did, you know, did some harm, did some good, but they started a conversation. Because if there had not been the work of these people put in these places, Harlem Hospital would not have gotten the psychiatric ward placed there at the time that it did. You needed all these things to lead up to that. And that leading up to that, it converged with a time in psychology, where a number of prominent Black psychiatrists and psychologists were coming to the fore and were able to move in the 70s past the point of this book and in the future coming from this book to move Black psychology and psychiatry into a new realm. So I get where we were at, and to understand where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. So this is very timely and resonant now because of some of the things that are happening in society as a whole now. So I'm feeling like I'm thankful for having this book and having the understanding so we know how to proceed forward.
The book we're talking about is Psychiatry and Racial Liberalism in Harlem, 1936 to 1968, a particularly important time in this field. And Dennis Doyle, the author, is here tonight at 5 p.m. He'll be at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. And he's going to be giving a talk alongside Ted Brown, professor of history and medical humanities. It's a Ted and Dennis talk there. And they're going to have a conversation about these issues, followed by a reception tonight. So that's 5 o'clock tonight at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. There's a lot of places I could go here. I want to talk about another thing that, as Melanie just mentioned, you got to know where you've been to know where you're going, and sometimes you see echoes. Well, one of the conversations that happens, I think, quite frequently today is Black representation in media. And I want to go back to Chapter 5 of the book, which is about the quiet one, and read a couple of the opening paragraphs and get our guests' thoughts about this. So I'll quote from the book now. The Quiet One debuted in New York City in 1948. This Academy Award-nominated film tells the fictional story of Donald Peters, a young African-American sent from Harlem to live at the Wiltwyck School for Boys in the Catskill Mountains. Hailed by most critics as an authentic and medically accurate portrayal of juvenile delinquency, the film was produced on location with the full cooperation of Wiltwyck, a private reform institution run by Justine Wise Polier, Viola Bernard, and other New Yorkers committed to preventing juvenile delinquency in Central Harlem's Black community. Now, despite otherwise rave reviews, at least one New York psychiatrist expressed dissatisfaction with the film. Hildy Mossey was among the city's growing number of race-blind clinicians. She had experience treating Harlemites, and she branded The Quiet One a misleading deception, claiming it grossly distorted the reality of Central Harlem's slums. Because, quote, the audience is led to believe that they are seeing a film about juvenile delinquency in general, rather than one about the special emotional challenges facing African-Americans growing up in a racist society, she wrote off the film as a dangerous misrepresentation of both Black life and delinquency in Harlem, end quote. And it goes on to talk about the importance of Black representation. But let me just start there. Dennis, you know, you open a chapter, you give it the title, The Quiet One. For those who don't know about The Quiet One, how significant a chapter in our history is this? And tell me more about sort of that push-pull between whether this was a medically accurate or was this a fair representation?
Oh, absolutely. At this point in time, there's something called mental hygiene films. Mental hygiene films were generally designed to try to educate the public about how to prevent mental illness. And almost to a single film, they almost never dealt with anyone other than whites. Always, every film was white, 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 white. There was maybe one film, I think, before this with Puerto Rican subject, and that was about it. And if I remember correctly, that was actually someone, a Puerto Rican of white descent. If I remember correctly. So this is a film, it's the first mental hygiene film that actually features African-Americans in it. And it was the first, and not only that, it's the first mental hygiene film to really get Oscar buzz, to be nominated, to kind of have a moment to alter the really horrific Hollywood, standard Hollywood depiction of African-Americans up until that point. Unfortunately, its lifespan never really lived beyond its first run, and in its showing in kind of charity circles, and never really made it to television, where it might have had a bigger impact.
Melanie, for you, what's the lesson here from The Quiet One?
Well, for me, is that when I read the whole... When I read the dismissal and the talk about being race blind, mm-hmm. in the movement at that time, people who were being race blind, color blind, a lot of times what they did was they were in the effort to not seem that they were being racist with the big air quotes, right? That they were substituting other words for race, such as class. And so when they talk about the slums, they were talking about this was where the culture of poverty was birthed. The whole idea of the culture of poverty and, you know, slum mothers and, you know, and blaming, you know, the reason that these things are happening is not because, you know, of redlining, is not because of urban renewal gone wrong, to quote Mr. Doyle, not because of these structural things, but because of these bad slum mothers and these bad. So my thing is, the quiet one, it showed how when you're getting care, one of the things of getting good therapeutic care is you become reflective and you become self-aware. And when you're self-aware, you can see yourself outside of yourself, and you can move differently, and you can see how to make different choices and different decisions. And that's what this movie showed, how someone was able to go through and do this thing. So it can happen. You know, you can say is that this, you know, something, another book that, another something that was talked about in the same time we were talking about was Man, Child, and the Promised Land, which is a book by Claude Brown.
Claude Brown, excellent. Yeah.
That highlights his journey. And the whole thing was, through the therapy, he became self-aware, and he recognized that, you know, now that I'm self-aware, I know that I can't do this good work in this environment. So he moved himself to a different environment. And what I want people to understand is, the quiet one was good in so much that it talks about we could do this stuff, but we can't dismiss context. We cannot dismiss, you know, we can say good therapy and all that, but if we do not fix, and these are things that persist today, if we do not work on eradicating, you know, the best way to fix a ghetto, a slum, a hood, is to eradicate it. That doesn't mean moving people out, and doesn't mean to decentralize poverty. It means to lift people out of poverty, mm-hmm. you know, and to reduce the stressors that cause these issues.
I ask about media representation because I think it's
huge.
It's so important. I'm going to bring up just a couple of points, and I'll start with you on this. Strange example, but one of the most it probably seemed benign at the time, because racism seems benign when it's happening. And then you look back and you go, wow, mid-80s, and I'm sure it did not seem benign to the African-American community in this country. But National Lampoon's Vacation has a scene where they are literally on vacation, and they roll through, I think, St. Louis?
Yes.
And
through St. Louis.
And you know, yes. they get robbed. And, mm-hmm. and the whole scene is this setup to get the Griswold family scared to be, you know, you would say, Melanie would point out, if I said in the slum, that's code for scared to be with black people who happen to rob them. I mean, a super racist scene looking back.
Absolutely.
And that starts to form belief, because largely white audiences see this and they may laugh and the scene may be funny to them. But then what do they leave with? This idea that, well, that's a dangerous
place. It's normalized.
That's why I think it's so important to talk about two things. How do you represent real struggle, because struggles are real, without also caricaturing it or creating sort of racist ideas in people's minds about, you know, what's normal or not. You know?
It's about seeing it. I think part of it is about being able to tell stories in context.
Yeah.
You know, what I told Mr. Doyle about what resonated is that I'm from New York originally, and a lot of my family lived in Harlem. And so the things that he said and things that are going on, I know that to be the history of where I grew up. And being able to tell a story in context. You know, I think the narrative, people love the narrative of this person pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, yeah. and did this thing, but we never talk about the structure around them. Or we'll talk about, well, their mother was bad. But if you live, you know, what makes this story right is because they lived in substandard housing. Why was the housing substandard? Because the community was redlined. Why was the community redlined? Because they wanted to keep people from moving. Why did they want, how did that happen? It was policy. Who did the policy? The federal government. You know, I mean, being able to tell the whole context of a story.
And yeah, that was what Hilda Moss really had a problem with. I mean, she really wanted to, wait a minute. I mean, you show, in the film, they show bits of Harlem, but they never explain, why are the windows broken? When they show buildings with broken windows, then they show store owners, and they happen to be white as opposed to local African Americans. What's the story behind that? They never explain any of that. So it's not explained, why are there gangs here, or how are these different than ordinary gays? None of that context is explained. And so that was kind of the problem she had with it, that you could just read this as a story of, this individual who through his own pluck.
And grit.
Yeah, that's it. You know, he was able to persevere as opposed to trying to get out the root of the story. We need to prevent more Donalds by preventing the environments where the Donalds are created.
And that's the thing is, like, if you show this neighborhood and you show, you know, like, if you show this neighborhood and you show abandoned lots, you see garbage on the lots and all this, and you don't give the the context that in this neighborhood there's redlining, so you can't get loans for home improvement, you know, and people are using these abandoned lots for illegal dumping, so people are coming from other neighborhoods and dumping their garbage here. You know, but when you see it and you see somebody and you hear the story of the pluck and the grit, you think, well, these people are terrible. They're dirty. Look at them. There's garbage there. But if you don't tell the story of how the garbage got there, why are the windows still broken? What has happened? Then, you know, that's why accurate, what I want to call multidimensional, deep and broad portrayals, accurate, deep and broad portrayals of African-Americans, people of color, any marginalized people in media is so necessary because that's what forms how you see yourself in the world.
Part of media is the news media. I used to work in commercial television news, and I have a lot of things I wrestle with myself when I look back on my own work there, because television news A-blocks are often stabbings, shootings, house fires. But things that don't really
they are selective stabbings,
they don't
get, shootings,
they don't get
and
context.
House fires.
They don't get a whole lot of context. Mm-mm. And is there a cumulative effect on the viewing population about how, you know, let's be honest, a lot of the crime that gets ends up getting reported on the news ends up being about people of color. Is there an effect there, too?
Absolutely, because my thing is, you know, people will say all the time, you know, did you hear that there was a fire such? No, I didn't hear about that. No, you didn't hear about it. Or did you hear that such and such a thing happened? I remember I had a friend who lived in a suburban area, which I'll remain nameless, where something really bad happened. And they said, I didn't hear about that on the news. I said, you're not going to. Why? Because it didn't happen on North Street. No one wants to believe that their neighborhood is inherently dangerous, so they're not. That's not going to make the news. You know, and people. And the thing is, what my thing is that I don't believe that it's always willful. Sometimes it is. But I believe that there are some implicit biases that people have that inform your interpretation, guide your intervention. How you see a thing is what you do about a thing. So I believe that people's implicit biases feed into what stories they want to pick up and things they what stories they want to tell. And a lot of times those are things that end up skewing the media because there's not enough diversity within the media. I mean, just not one black anchor does not a culturally competent workforce make.
Yeah, and Jill in Pittsford writes on the subject of the number of African American psychologists. Again, that number, according to the American Psychological Association, just 5.3% of the active psychology workforce. Jill says 2010 census says African Americans make up just over 13% of the population. 5.3%. I mean, is that a crisis? How low is that? Very low to you? I mean, that's less than half of a representative population.
Right. All right. If you take less than half of the representative population, but then you take all the things we've been talking about so far this hour about about the exposures to trauma and, you know, if you talk about poverty and exposure to trauma and all these things, that would increase our need.
Yeah, more critical need, yeah.
So there's more. I think our need outweighs our prevalence in the population, but our presence, the amount of people we have to meet that need is less than the way we appear in a population.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
I totally agree with that. That happens throughout, I think, throughout history of medicine. We have all these examples of situations where, for example, in Chicago, just recently, in the south side of Chicago, they haven't had a level one adult trauma unit in essentially the neighborhood in the United States with the highest rate of gunshot fatalities. And they never had an adult one trauma unit until this year. So here I have a community who has a critical health need more than disproportionately than any other community. And yet I grew up in a town that had little to no gunshot fatalities, yet we had an adult one trauma center. Why did we have that? As opposed to Chicago, Southside, predominantly African American, not having this, what for their particular public health community needs, unnecessary service.
I'm late for our only break of the hour. Let's take that now, and we'll come back. You're hearing Dennis Doyle, who's an associate professor of history at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy and author of the book Psychiatry and Racial Liberalism in Harlem, 1936 to 1968. He's in Rochester today for a talk tonight at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. It starts at 5 p.m. Melanie Funches is Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. When we come back, we're going to take the what we learned in the three decades of this book and then catapult to the modern era here. What has changed with disparities? And there are some conclusions that Dennis draws in the book that I think are pretty firm and important. We'll talk about some of those as well and talk more about mental health, particularly in the African-American community, as we go forward. That's next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, a story of alleged sexual misconduct regarding the actor and comedian Aziz Ansari has gripped much of the online community, a lot of discussions in the Me Too movement. We'll discuss the complexity of that story and what it means for how we talk about sex with men, with women, going forward. The Aziz Ansari case, Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dennis's book gets us thinking about the difference of generations ago and today when it comes to mental health care in the African-American community, and talking about how in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, idea being that, well, can African-Americans handle psychiatric intervention? You know, maybe psychosis is a somewhat normal part of the black psyche, you know, all these super racist ideas. And so the hope is that, well, boy, haven't we really kind of emerged from that? I want to read from part of your conclusion a little bit here, because I'm feeling pretty bleak.
Sorry.
Quoting.
My book does that to people.
Well, you know, quote, within mental health care, racial disparities continued and even worsened from the 1960s onward. Entering the 21st century, the era of biopsychiatry and deinstitutionalization, the rate at which blacks were diagnosed with psychosis had not declined. It increased. Studies conducted between 2003 and 2009 showed that African Americans had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders at a rate that was three times higher than that for whites. Blacks were far more likely to have their mental health needs met in public institutions and emergency care units than in private outpatient care facilities. And whereas black children within the juvenile justice system had been denied access to mental health care before the 1960s, efforts to end this inequity eventually produced an overabundance of institutionalized black youth offenders receiving some mental health attention. The U.S. justice system's steadily increasing tendency to assign black children's cases a psychological dimension coincided with historically unprecedented rates of black male incarceration in the late 20th and early 21st century. That is a bleak picture, and it's complex. I mean, so there's a number of things I want to hit at here, but let's start with this, Dennis. I mean, you know, in a moment we'll get to more of your conclusions where you want people to at least understand power structures and you know, people who talk about post-racial tend to be people who have power, and they tend to act like race doesn't matter when obviously it does. And I know you note that in your conclusion. What's going to change what I just read there? What's going to make that change?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know, but what are some steps here?
First is some recognition that there are racial disparities, which working at School of Pharmacy, and we do kind of community interventions, trying to convince people that race matters, that it's not, you know, in somebody's head, that race does produce health outcomes that are real and disparate. That's one of the first places to start, because there's so many people who don't believe this that's happening.
Melanie Funches.
I absolutely agree with you that we have to acknowledge that these disparities are real and that race matters. And also what we need to do is work on creating culturally responsive approaches to care.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that is both the what and the how and the who. You know, expanding and diversifying our workforce. That means going into high school, junior high school, start talking to young people about going into these fields and showing them that and creating a supported path for them to do this work, you know, and then going into places, bringing them into the fields with mentorships and things like this that other people get. Now, don't get this twisted. These are things that happen. They just don't happen a lot for people of color, for African Americans. So I'm not asking for something new that doesn't happen to anybody everywhere, you know. So that we have to have ways to diversify the workforce, bring more people of color into the workforce, and bring in more culturally responsive approaches to care. This is not just in psychiatry. This is across medicine. Yeah. This is across education. We need culturally responsive pedagogy and education, because if we educate our kids to see themselves and understand that this thing is a real thing, then they will be receptive to picking up these other things later on as career choices, coming and doing work in their communities. This is a whole life course thing that we need to do, and that will help us.
All right, there's a couple of things here that come to mind for me that aren't stated explicitly in the conclusion of Dennis's book, but I'd like our guest to give me a pass or fail grade here as I assess what's going on here. Because go back to the beginning when we talked about John Henryism, the psychic cost of simply being African American, the toll that it can take dealing with racism, structural, systemic, personal racism, on a daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly basis, means, as Melanie pointed out, research indicates that if you're an African-American, I think you mentioned women, I don't know if it's true for
yes,
women.
Yes, it's true for men.
Okay. That there's essentially a 7.5-year aging curve.
Oh, the age curve is, be very clear, I don't know what the age curve is for men, because that was a study done with women.
Okay.
But there are, just like the medical tolls of the psychic trauma of being black in America, it weighs on men and women okay. as well.
And so there are all kinds of studies about hypertension, blood pressure. There are studies about rates of depression when you get good diagnosis and under other mental health challenges, suicide attempts, all of these related to kind of the psychic cost of being African American. So when we see higher rates of diagnosis with the various disorders that I just listed, I assume two things, and I don't know if this is right or wrong. Number one, there may in fact be higher rates of various disorders in the black community that are properly diagnosable, but they come from enduring structural racism. The racism that exists in society are the seeds that lead to higher rates of disorder. But also, the incarceration and the institutionalization that comes often with kids is sometimes misdirected because of a racist assumption. Well, that person is psychotic. That person is this or that. We'll institutionalize this person, well, as opposed to the way white kids or white people would be treated. Dennis, how am I doing there?
Oh, part of it has to deal with, and there's actually an excellent book. I'm trying to remember. Emily Martin, she did work on essentially manic depression, and she had a couple chapters where she touched on the fact that she found in some of the clinicians she was talking to who diagnosed manic depression that they had a difficult time trying to unpack people who came in from who were essentially African American and trying to disentangle the symptoms they were expressing from the way they were expressing it. The culturally specific African-American way of expressing those symptoms that sometimes it's difficult for a white clinician to kind of disentangle the symptoms from it. And so it was difficult for them to make 100% correct, accurate diagnoses of manic depression. And that's also been found for schizophrenia, in bipolar, borderline personality disorder, where in this era of teaching cultural competency in medical schools, for whatever reason, we're not doing a very good job of producing clinicians who are able to be familiar enough with black cultural style and black cultural expression that they're able to disentangle psychosis from what they may perceive to be, bizarre or strange behavior. And this has been documented. This is still happening where people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That, and it goes back to the implicit bias where many people, this is one of the things I teach my classes is that many people get informed, especially since we live in such a so-called de facto segregated society, we have so many folks who never met someone from another race, and they get their ideas
or at least really interact with
them. Yeah, or interact with them on a real substantial basis. And so they get their ideas informed through television, music, video
games. Media representation.
Yeah.
There it is.
And that's what they bring to the table. So you can get all the cultural competency training you want, but at the end of the day, it's what you saw in that movie last night and the way that African-Americans were portrayed in it that's going to inform your process of thinking. When you walk in and you have this patient who yesterday, you know, tried to set fire to his pants, and you're trying to figure out where do you place this person, you're going to have in your head, whether you like it or not, that film that you saw that may have contained some images of African Americans that's not going to lead to a great diagnosis.
And that's still a problem, melanin.
And thank you, Dennis. What I want to say is that while there are stressors and all these things, there is also, because of all the things that Dennis has talked about, a high level of misdiagnosis and overdiagnosis. And that has been borne out in the literature of African Americans.
Oh, for sure.
You know, where you hear about it a lot is the misdiagnosis of schizophrenia among African Americans. It happened, like he said, it happens with bipolar. It happens with borderline personality disorder. It happens in our kids with ADHD. You know, and so because people do not understand the way many African Americans organically experience the world, and the way we use language to articulate that is something that is different than the way white people do. And because they try to do it in this Eurocentric white construct, they end up missing it. That's why I keep going back to the need for culturally responsive approaches to care that teach people how, if you're hearing someone speaking in African American vernacular English, this does not mean this. Like, an example that I use of this real quickly is I was doing some research with a research partner, and we were looking at Twitter, and the hashtag was #bodybag, right? And the person was white, and they said, "Oh, that means violence." I said, "No, that doesn't mean violence. That means the issue squashed." And the person did not believe me and said, "No, that's violence." I'm like, "No, it's not." And so what I had to do is I had to go get three African-American teenage boys to bring them in and said, "Yo, #bodybag, what that mean?" "Oh, that's dead." And she said, "See, violence." I said, "No, what does dead mean?" "Oh, it's over. It's squashed." But because it was a linguistic difference.
Yeah.
But so imagine if someone's going in and speaking in this vernacular and using this English, and the person who's listening to them thinks that they're speaking of violence when they're talking about resolving a dispute. And this person has the power to do diagnosis.
And clinical encounters today are so short. They're much shorter than even during the period I was studying. They're, a few minutes, and then your fate's sealed. You now have a file on you. You're schizophrenic. After just this clinical encounter that lasted a few minutes.
And that's a lot of that is driven by insurance, because in order to get paid by the insurance, you have to give a diagnosis.
Yeah.
So you're not getting enough time to get to know the person, and you're taking these few little snippets that you get in a window shot in time where you don't necessarily understand the language, and you're making a diagnosis that fouls that person potentially for the rest of their life.
I want to make one point before we lose the hour, because a listener named Don writes and says, "Evan, regarding the news, crime rates really are higher in the city. That's why you see it on the news more often. Bias may exist, but that's not the meat of the problem." Don, I appreciate the email. Let me just respond to that. Having worked in commercial television news, now having worked for public radio. Yes, crime rates are higher in American cities. The problem is this. You are not going to get stabbed if you go to Rochester today. I promise. It's just not going to happen to you. Getting stabbed happens almost always in interpersonal violence, disputes over sometimes person-to-person theft or personal disputes, etc. And those things happen in areas where there is more poverty. Poverty happens because of structural issues that go back a long, long time here and have very deep roots. Now, I'm not saying crime doesn't exist. I'm not saying shootings don't happen, stabbings don't happen. They happen in the suburbs. They happen in the city. They happen more in the city. But when you, suburban viewer, often a white viewer, watch the news and you see, in the city, and you see police headlights and these scary graphics and stabbing here and shooting there, and you think, "I'm not going to Rochester," that is a reaction to a reality that doesn't really exist for you, and you don't get the broader understanding of, number one, why that's happened, who it's happening to, and the fact that you're not going to get stabbed if you go to Rochester today. You are not. Okay, that's all. Sorry. That's all I wanted to say about that. Anyway, some final thoughts here. Dennis Doyle. Dennis Doyle speaking tonight, 5 o'clock, Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. He's an associate professor of history at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy and author of Psychiatry and Racial Liberalism in Harlem, 1936 to 1968. That talk tonight from 5 to 6:30 with a reception to follow. Thanks for taking the time. I know your travel schedule is tight right off a plane, and we've grabbed you right here into the studio. Thank you for making it work and for talking about these issues.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And Melanie Funchess, it's always good to have you. Melanie is Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. I don't mean to oversimplify complex issues, but you do so much to help us understand them. Thank you for being here, and I always appreciate your
time. Thank you for the opportunity.
You got it. And our thanks to Tim George, engineering the program today. Thank you, Tim. Mike Black, behind the glass. Hi, Mike. Megan Mack, Mike didn't really do anything today. Mike's always doing something. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we are right back with you Thursday. I'm member-supported public radio. Go to Rochester!